Applying the terrorism label to environmental activism.
We were all arrested for hanging these leaflets on people's doors in a residential neighborhood related to an animal testing company. And the really important part of that story, though, is that a couple weeks later, I was visited by two FBI agents at home who said I could either cooperate with them, which meant spying on local animal rights and environmental activists and becoming a government informant, or that they would put me on the domestic terrorist list.
That's Will Potter. We talk with him about his book, Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. Then nature writer David Gessner tells us about his trip down the Charles River and how it inspired his Green Manifesto. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Earth Day is celebrated this week. It's a time when the media gives the environment its one week in the sun before going back to what those endlessly fascinating Republicans are doing, or something like that. As listeners know, environmental issues are something we talk about a lot on this show, and not just during the third week in April. But one thing we haven't talked about is what's happening to those who fight to save the environment. Because there's a war being waged against environmental and animal activists that's getting really scary, and it has huge implications for free speech, as well as our ability to save our civilization and the planet. Activists guilty of infractions ranging from chaining themselves to trees or freeing animals from labs are being labeled as terrorists, despite the fact that nobody has gotten hurt, and subject to long prison sentences under draconian conditions. Even mere leafleters are being treated as terrorists. Journalist Will Potter joins us to talk about this assault on environmental activists. His book is Green is the New Red. I asked him what the title refers to. Will Potter, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, Green is the New Red, first, for those of our listeners who may not get the title, could you tell us what is it in reference to?
The title's in reference to what may be the most notorious era of government repression in U.S. history, of the Red Scare of the 40s and 50s. And comparing that to what's going on right now with labeling environmentalists and animal rights activists as the number one domestic terrorism threat. And so I use the comparison to really draw out how this has all happened and how the power of language and labeling people as terrorists has been used in both of those eras to threaten people's civil rights.
You start out with a bang, I would say. You have a kind of interesting relationship that you even struggle with, one as a journalist and another as a participant in the environmental movement in the way in which we're talking about it in this book. Tell us your story, the story you start the book out with.
Sure. Well, my background is in newspapers and magazines, and for a time I was in Chicago working at the Chicago Tribune, covering mostly crime reporting on the Metro desk, kind of breaking news, blood and guts, cop shop reporting. And at the time, you know, it was leaving me feeling really, frankly, depressed and detached. It wasn't the type of journalism I felt like how I was having any positive impact on the world. And it really conflicted with my background as not only a journalist, but as an activist as well, and my, you know, my concern for different social movements. So I decided to go out one afternoon leafleting with the local animal protection group. And in my mind, it was the most I could be involved with anything. Working at a place like the Chicago Tribune, I could not be out protesting or doing anything like that. So I thought handing out leaflets was pretty safe. Well, it turns out we were all arrested for hanging these leaflets on people's doors in a residential neighborhood outside of Chicago related to an animal testing company. And the really important part of that story, though, is that a couple weeks later, I was visited by two FBI agents at home who said I could either cooperate with them, which meant spying on local animal rights and environmental activists and becoming a government informant, or that they would put me on a domestic terrorist list. And this was about 6 or 9 months after September 11th. So needless to say, it was an eye-opening and shocking experience. And I was never able to shake that question of how did that happen? Like, why would I, and presumably other people, be visited by the FBI for something like this? And why are these types of protest activity being labeled as terrorism?
Leafleting being labeled as terrorism.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. John L. Lewis, who you quote in the book, he's a counterterrorism expert for the FBI, speaks for the FBI spokesperson, said in front of Congress, quote, "Animal rights extremists and eco-terrorism is our highest domestic terrorism investigation priority." So are the kinds of things that they are investigating terrorism?
I argue in the book, no. I mean, to be clear, the animal rights and environmental movements are like every other social movement, and that there's been a wide range of activity. So there are people that write letters, people like me who went out leafleting, people who lobby, work at nonprofits, and then there are people who break the law, either through nonviolent civil disobedience or through property destruction. It's important to point out, though, that in the history of these movements, unlike other social justice movements, they've never gone further and actually targeted human beings and used physical violence against human beings. And so when I'm examining the use of this word terrorism in the book, a real key component to me was trying to answer how social movements who have never actually harmed people are being hit with a label that I think for most Americans is intimately associated with physical violence against people, with September 11th, with bombing open-air markets and things like that.
One of the central cases that you really follow throughout the book and is still pretty much alive in some ways, well, at least the organization that formed to go against it, is the case of Huntington Life Sciences. What was Huntington Life Sciences? This was in England. And how did this whole case kind of kick up this response to so-called eco-terrorism in such an extreme manner?
Huntington Life Sciences, or HLS, is a contract animal testing company with laboratories in England and in New Jersey. And it became an international target of animal rights activists after multiple undercover investigations exposed lab workers doing things like punching beagle puppies in the face and dissecting live primates. I mean, really, truly egregious stuff that got international news. Well, a campaign was formed and began in the UK with the sole purpose of putting this lab out of business. And they went about it in a unique way. They, not only targeted and protested the company itself, but kind of drawing on the playbook of the anti-apartheid movement, they targeted anyone who had any business relationship with the laboratory. So that meant UPS, FedEx, investment banks, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs. I mean, anyone who had any investment in the lab or any business that did things like provide a service, like delivering toilet paper or, you know, anything you can think of. The rationale was that these companies were desperately needed by Huntington to stay afloat, but the companies didn't need Huntington. That tactic of campaigning was incredibly effective. And what's also important to note about the campaign was that unlike a lot of other protest campaigns, these activists openly supported a wide range of activity. So they did things like protests and leaflet, but they also, on their website and in their words, supported people who released animals from laboratories and destroyed property. Now, the activists who were brought into court were not charged with anything like that. They were charged with running a website that allegedly was part of a conspiracy to commit terrorism by protesting in this way. And so it became a really important First Amendment case and a test of how far this terrorism rhetoric could be used.
Yeah, so talk a little bit more about the First Amendment implications. I mean, this is a very detailed discussion, but hit the high notes for us.
I think the most important thing to understand with any discussion of terrorism in the First Amendment is not that these laws or these court cases are trying to outlaw First Amendment activity. That hasn't overwhelmingly has not been the case. The real danger here is what attorneys call a chilling effect. In other words, it's not about outlawing free speech, but it's making people think twice about using their rights. People and activists have talked to hundreds across the country in a lot of different social movements, and they see the writing on the wall. They see the surveillance being used by the government, in many cases illegally. They see these outrageous court cases, disproportionate prison sentences, the focus of the FBI in congressional hearings, in Homeland Security surveillance. And they have to think twice about speaking up for what they believe in the event that they might be labeled a terrorist. That's a chilling effect. And I think that's the true danger and the true attack on the First Amendment right now, is that these corporations and politicians are using the word terrorism so recklessly, and it's making people afraid to speak up.
And just so our listeners get an understanding of what you mean by disproportionate prison sentences, could you give us some examples of where people were convicted for long sentences for relatively what maybe common sense would say pretty minor crimes?
Well, one recent example is Tim DeChristopher, who's an environmental activist in Utah. He disrupted an oil and gas lease auction by placing false bids. He saw public lands being given away to corporations for next to nothing, and so he raised his bidder's paddle, even though he knew he was a poor student. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison for that act of disruption and nonviolent civil disobedience, and he's currently imprisoned right now. On the other end of the spectrum of people who have actually sabotaged property, which is clearly a crime, and there's no mistaking that, but in some cases these activists have received over 20 years in prison as a terrorist for destroying property. And so I would throw out there to your listeners and to everyone else, regardless of how you feel about the politics and regardless of whether you feel that it's a smart thing to do to go out and destroy bulldozers or whatever, should they be sent with 22 years in prison?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually this, although much of the intensity was ratcheted up after 9/11, and we'll talk about that. This is also happening under the Obama administration, for example, the case of Tim Christopher. You also contrast a case of Marie Mason being prosecuted and getting a heavy prison sentence. You contrast it to four people who physically attacked black voters during the last election. Could you give us this contrast here?
Well, I think that's the juxtaposition precisely, is that at a time when all these resources are being spent on environmentalists and they're being sentenced, as Marie Mason was, to 21 years in prison for her acts of sabotage, you have groups that have histories, long histories, of physical violence, from anti-abortion extremists who have murdered doctors and nurses to the Ku Klux Klan, people like in the example you mentioned that I wrote about, who set out on the election night of President Barack Obama and beat African Americans who they perceived to have voted for a black president with pipes and sticks, and ran over one man with their car. The FBI put out press releases on this, and of course they were arrested and went before the court, but nowhere was that word terrorist used. And I go even further in the book and comb through Homeland Security and FBI documents and see a consistent pattern before 9/11 and after 9/11 of a refusal to label these kind of right-wing extremists as terrorism threats.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with journalist Will Potter about his book, Green is the New Red. It's about how the environmentalists are being labeled terrorists and being given long prison sentences far out of proportion to their crimes, crimes that often merely involve exercising their free speech rights. Give us the case of Daniel McGowan. This is also a central one, and I believe that there's also been a movie, a documentary made of him, about him.
That's right. Daniel McGowan was the protagonist in If a Tree Falls, which was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. And McGowan is also a key figure in my book as well. And I was actually in the filmmakers and I kind of overlapped in some spots as we're talking with him. And the reason I chose to focus on Daniel McGowan is that he's an example of someone who actually has done, you know, in the scheme of the Earth Liberation Front and illegal activities by underground groups, he was involved in two arsons and two serious property crimes. So I wanted to present him as an example of, you know, at the worst of these types of cases, you know, he's actually helped burn some facilities down. He was involved in two arsons against the logging of old growth forests and genetic engineering. He was convicted, sentenced to prison as a terrorist, and he is now actually in a experimental prison unit right now called a communications management unit. And there are two of these facilities in the country, in Terre Haute, Indiana, and in Marion, Illinois. And they are, according to the government, for so-called domestic terrorist prisoners. And Daniel McGowan is being housed there with radical restrictions on his communications with the outside world. For instance, he's not able to hug his wife, to hug his niece. He's not able to have any contact visits. And he only has several hours of visitation a month compared to, which is a radically different amount than the average prisoner. So, I mean, this is also an example of when people are hit with that label of a terrorist, it follows them throughout the entire criminal justice system. I mean, before they enter the courtroom, McGowan was labeled as terrorist. During the criminal proceedings, the government pushed for a terrorism enhancement. And then after he admitted his involvement, he was sent to this special communications management unit for domestic terrorists.
It reminds me of the case of Sylvia Baraldini and Susan Rosenberg. I've spoken to Susan Rosenberg. These were people who were involved in the supporting the Black liberation struggle in the 1980s, who were sentenced to 50 years in prison, and who were put into the first, you know, before the Supermax, the first Supermax units, with you know, lights on all the time and solitary confinement and things of that kind. So it's kind of
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, and Susan Rosenberg's book, An American Radical, is fantastic, and I encourage people to look into that. And she was housed in the Lexington High Security Unit, which was ultimately shut down. And I think we see a trajectory, though, over the last 30 to 40 years of, you know, every time one of these facilities is shut down, a different incarnation pops up. And I think that's what these communication management units are. They're not the same as the Lexington HSU or some of these other prisons, but it's an evolution of an attempt to work outside of the law and outside of the confines of the criminal justice system for people because of their political beliefs.
Exactly. And we did interview Susan Rosenberg, so our listeners can go to our website to find that. We're talking with Will Potter about his book, Green is a New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. Talk a little bit more about the kind of mindset of this social movement. One thing that was new to me is how connected it is to punk rock and the straight edge ethos, and maybe contrast it to, you know, the maybe more mainstream environmental movement.
I think that's a really interesting point, and one that I wish I had more time to expand on in the book, and that there definitely is a theme running through a lot of the more grassroots animal rights and environmental movements, and particularly on the animal rights side, but also in the environmental movement as well, of having a connection to the punk and hardcore scenes, to the straight edge movement, to, I guess at its core, the similarity between all that is a passionate belief in a do-it-yourself ethic. So in punk rock, that's often, you know, printing your own T-shirts, your own flyers, booking your own shows, making zines, that kind of thing. And I think a lot of the grassroots components of these movements approach their work in the same way as well. I mean, one of the lines I had in the book about the Shack campaign was that these activists, instead of deciding to form a band or book their own tour, they went out and decided to shut down a multinational corporation. And they had no training in finance or economics or anything like that, but they taught themselves. And I think that's a really useful way of understanding what's going on in these movements. And it's not to say it's universal. And like you said, the more mainstream environmental movement it continues to grow, and this experience isn't a universal reflection of that. But I think it helps explain where these activists are coming from.
And when you said SHAC, that is the group that went to shut down Huntington Life Sciences, and they were successful. Is that correct?
Well, the lab has not shut down. They were successful in bringing the share prices of this company down to pennies on the dollar at multiple points. And now the campaign continues. Just a few days ago, there was a massive leak of documents related to HLS, to Huntington Life Sciences and Huntington investors. So the campaign is still going, but the prosecution of these activists certainly was a turning point.
Now, you mentioned 9/11. This kind of stuff did happen before, but what did change after 9/11?
I think after 9/11, the biggest change was an opening of the floodgates for financing, for money. There are millions of dollars flowing out of the federal and state governments for Homeland Security funding and identifying and investigating groups as terrorists. And as a result, we saw a shifting of government priorities to accommodate this. And some of the examples I talk about in the book are, for instance, in Texas, these Homeland Security fusion centers that were identifying dozens and dozens of groups, everybody from the Hell's Angels to People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals to women's rights groups, anti-abortion protesters, pro-choice protesters, and all being wrapped up in the same way. So what we're seeing is this kind of institutional pressure to demonstrate that there are terrorist threats in order to get the terrorist financing so that the money can flow into the states. On top of that, there's this occupational pressure. As I talked to former FBI agents who described, you know, in the 1980s, there was a pressure to deliver results in the war on drugs, or the so-called war on gangs. And with 9/11, that all changed. If you weren't involved in a terrorism investigation, I mean, you were really kind of marginalizing your career potential, as some former FBI agents described it. So I think, you know, there was across the board, an institutional shift to this terrorism rhetoric affecting all aspects of government.
I mean, this is pretty terrifying, because what you're saying is that you're showing kind of the development of this anti-so-called terrorism industrial complex, where, you know, what's driving it is profit and money.
Absolutely. I think there's can be no denying that, and I don't think that's any exaggeration whatsoever. You know, and we're seeing that right now being completely institutionalized. I mean, you mentioned earlier the shift from to the Obama administration, and one of the most common questions I get at speaking events and in interviews is, has anything changed? And I think the biggest change is that all of this has become so strikingly normal. You know, remember during the Bush administration, when the Patriot Act passed, it was incredibly controversial when this NSA spying program, the National Security Agency spying on Americans, that was incredibly controversial. As time goes by, this is all being codified into law, and it's just being accepted as how the government functions. So the fact that the Obama administration has not only embraced these existing policies, but in some cases pushed them a bit further to, you know, the first uses of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act were under the Obama administration. I think that really reflects the path we've gone down and how difficult it is to change course.
Well, tell us about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. You, Will Potter, you testified before Congress about the act, and you speak about that in your book, Green is the New Red.
The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act passed in 2006, and it was the culmination of many years of lobbying by corporations like Pfizer, Wyeth, GlaxoSmithKline, organizations like the Fur Commission, National Association for Biomedical Research, Ringling Brothers, any business entity you can think of that has a tie in any way to using animals was involved in lobbying for this legislation. And what it does is it takes an existing law that was already vague, and as we talked about previously, was used to convict the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty activist as terrorists, and it makes it even more vague and even more broad. It wraps up anyone who not only targets a so-called animal enterprise, but targets in protest anyone who's connected to an animal enterprise and causes the loss of corporate profits. Now, this legislation is being challenged right now in court by the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is a really positive and, I think, inspiring development. But there's a long way to go. It's been put to use a few times so far in some troubling cases. But as it stands, this law is on the books.
And, you know, there are other laws we've heard about more recently, state legislatures taking up bills barring undercover videos of CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations. I mean, it seems that it's not just tamping down on the free speech of activists, but it's also going after after the free speech of journalists, the First Amendment.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really important point. And in my opinion, this is the single most disturbing development in years related to all this. And to clarify, I mean, with these what are being called ag gag bills being introduced around the country, and what they do at the state level is they are criminalizing undercover investigators who produce videos or photo audio documentation of what takes place in factory farms and the animal abuses, animal welfare violations that take place. They're trying to single out this specific group of people because of the lobbying of the pork industry, the cattle industry, and things like that. The real danger, of course, is not just for the people doing the investigating, but like you said, it's for journalists as well. And this is really having a chilling effect on journalists. On top of that, I mean, even for your listeners who have no intention of doing anything like this, it's really an attempt to keep consumers in the dark. And that's why the industry is doing this. They don't want people to know where your food comes from. And I think that's something everybody should be concerned about as well.
Yeah. Will Potter, you also say in The Green is Red that the government itself acknowledges that the people they label eco-terrorists are not in fact threatening people, that they're threatening profits. And yet, how do they justify the label?
We've seen this time and again in some of the internal documents from the FBI, congressional reports and things like that are quite open about the fact that they don't think animal rights and environmental activists are actually going to be harming human beings. And in fact, I went through all of the Inspector General reports by the Justice Department for the last 15 years or so. And the Inspector General advised the FBI to stop targeting animal rights and environmental activists as terrorists because it was a waste of government resources that could be better spent targeting threats to human life. Mm-hmm. And the FBI simply responded, no, we are not going to do that. So I think it's really striking the belligerence in maintaining this course when the FBI, you know, the Justice Department's own Inspector General has advised against it is really staggering to me. The only way, in my opinion, to explain it is the corporate influence on this political process, on the courts. I mean, we've seen cases of corporations calling up judges and expressing their interest in the case. And time and again, I think this is what all of it comes back to, is the corporate influence on all aspects of our democracy.
Will Potter. We talk more with him about his book, Green is the New Red, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with journalist Will Potter about the government's assault on the environmental movement. He says it shows the influence of corporate polluters on our government and their quest to protect their profits at the expense of the planet. You also say that there's more at stake, that it goes beyond the threatening of profits to a wider culture war, a perceived threat, almost like the war against communism, a perceived threat to what the government and the corporations who are involved in this pressure see as civilization.
Right. So to expand on that analogy a little bit more, during the Red Scare, I identified what I would say are two distinct types of threats. I mean, there was a direct threat posed by communists and subversives of stealing government secrets and passing them on to another nation state, right? And then there's the indirect threat, which was actually the much more pervasive and the much more, endemic of changing cultural values. So that's why we had the FBI maintaining files on the movie It's a Wonderful Life and labeling it as communist propaganda. I mean, it really reflects the scope of this cultural threat. It was an attack on the American way of life. That's how communism was perceived during the Red Scare. And I argue those two distinct types of threats are at work today as well, or they're perceived that way today. And the direct threat is some of the activist groups we've talked about, from national organizations down to the Animal Liberation Front and Earth Liberation Front. They're directly threatening corporate profits. The indirect threat is that, this is all happening at a time when everyone is going green or says that they're going green. We have Mark Bittman writing today in the New York Times about animal welfare violations and going vegetarian. I mean, we just have all of these things conflating that really reflect a cultural shift that's taking place. An awareness of these issues I don't think has ever happened before. And if you look at the rhetoric of the industry groups and of corporations and politicians, it's not just the financial threat. They really see this as a threat to an entire way of life. I mean, if you act on these values of environmental values and respect for other species, it really calls into question a lot of other choices of how we live our lives. There's some kind of funny examples of this that I found in the book of corporations and industry groups warning people about, these crazy environmentalists, they want you to eat only tofu and stop driving cars and all this kind of stuff. But, there's some truth to that, right? they're asking people to reflect on how they live their lives. And if we do that, there is a lot of reflection we need to do from everything about our transportation system, our agricultural system, everything about how we live our lives. And I think that's the cultural threat. And I think it's a lot like that the Red Scare in this regard of seeing everything as the tip of the iceberg. Everything is just seen as this representation of, an avalanche that may be coming down the mountain. And there's this just reckless attempt to stop it every step of the way. I think that's the only way we can explain how some of these groups are labeling the Humane Society as a terrorist organization, labeling the Sierra Club and Greenpeace. I mean, these are established and in some ways more mainstream environmental and animal protection groups being labeled as terrorists as well, because they're all seen as a threat.
This past weekend, I took my granddaughter to see The Lorax. She's just turning 8. The theater was filled with kids who totally got this movie, who were calling back to the screen. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's kind of, the corporate tycoon, Mr. O'Hare, who is against the trees because the trees make air for free. And and the kids were like yelling at him to stop. I thought this is a real cultural shift. So I want to ask you, on the one hand, there is this cultural shift that is reaching, the kids really do get it. My granddaughter turned to me and she said, I'm really worried about the environment. I'm worried about what's going to happen. She knows what's ahead. And on the other hand, this incredible crackdown, this incredible repression that is, like the gulag, American gulag.
And that's the juxtaposition, right? I mean, the irony of all of this taking place is it's taking place at a time when, like you said, there's awareness of these issues like never before. I see, even SUVs driving around town with, you know, environmental bumper stickers and things like that. Like, everyone, at least at the surface, has embraced some degree of these values, is how it seems. The way I would explain it is, there's going to be a real tension in the next several years of how the environmental movement and the animal rights movement maintain the integrity of their values and how they act on them in the face of what environmentalists would call greenwashing, you know, the attempt by corporations to just say, well, if you care about the environment, all you need to do is go out and buy this new product. I mean, that's what we're being told is the new way of being an environmentalist. Just go buy this. Buy this type of car or this type of light bulb or whatever. And those things might be important, but there's going to be a real pressure to say, no, you know, we have to do more than that. We have to go further than that. And I think the thread that I've seen in my work is that the people that are really doing that, whether it's people like Tim DeChristopher using nonviolent civil disobedience, or it's people like Daniel McGowan who have actually destroyed property, when you go beyond the greenwashing and you actually put those values into practice in a meaningful way and threaten corporate profits, that's when the backlash begins. And I think that's going to be the real challenge moving forward.
Well, your book is a fascinating guide to this, an important one. Green is a New Red. Will Potter, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can read an excerpt from Green is a New Red by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, nature writer David Gester's Green Manifesto. David Gessner writes wonderful books about nature, like Return of the Osprey and Soaring with Fidel. But when he took a canoe trip down the Charles River, he wasn't seeing pristine, unspoiled wilderness, but the wildness that still remains in and among our human-built environment. It got him thinking about a new approach to environmentalism, one that embraces the limited wild, as he calls it, to make us aware of what we still have and to protect it. His book is My Green Manifesto, Down the Charles River in Pursuit of a New Environmentalism.
And it's kind of about the evolution of my environmental thought from Sick of Nature, which I wrote a few years back, to the present. And that evolution was really about me getting less pure environmentally and embracing a wilder and funnier and kind of more hypocritical environmentalism. And coincidentally, as my thinking was growing this way, I went down the Charles River with Dan Driscoll, who's an eco-planner for the state of Massachusetts, and he kind of embodied that same sort of spirit, like not a nature shaman whispering in hushed whispers, but a kind of funny salt-of-the-earth guy. And so I thought, this is a good match. We've got Dan, we've got this funny trip where we've got a case of beer in the canoe, and I've got these evolving ideas about how environmentalism, or at least my environmentalism, has changed.
And it's a wonderful discourse and a kind of conversation that you have the reader have with the book because of this. But, you know, I bet some of our listeners are saying to themselves, what does he mean, hypocritical environmentalism?
Right. Well, this is what I mean by it. And I'll let Dan rather, you know, speak for both of us. We were paddling on the second day of our trip, heading toward Boston, and Dan said, you know, we're all hypocrites. We all drive cars. We take plane rides. I mean, people like Al Gore or Bill McKibben have to fly to give their lecture about using less fuel. But we're hypocrites, and then we kind of say that lets us off the hook. We say, well, I use a car. I use a plane, so I can't really be an environmentalist. And he says, screw that. We need more environmentalists who fight. We need to say, okay, I'm a hypocrite. I'm part of these times. I can't avoid the car world. But I'm going to fight for some causes. And so I loved when he said that. And I thought, this is a limited environmentalism, not a either-or purist environmentalism. And it really matched what we were seeing on the way into the city, where we were seeing kind of all these moments of wildness and seeing birds, but we were going into, you know, a large metropolitan area. So I liked that too. It was a limited wild, and it was a limited environmentalism too.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Dan. Actually, tell us about his relationship with the Charles River. What has he done?
Yeah, well, at first, I only knew Dan because I played on an Ultimate Frisbee team with him, and we called him Danimal because he threw his body around and dove after Frisbees and had all this energy. And then one day after playing, I started a conversation and asked him what he did. And the conversation really turned into the book, because what he did 20 years ago was take a position as an eco-planner on the DCR, Department of Conservation and Recreation in Boston. And he was the young guy, so they gave him some maps and said, why don't you work on the Charles? And this was a thankless task, because there was no way you could do much with the Charles. It's so famously polluted, it was the Scandell song, Dirty Water. But Dan started to dig in and look, and he saw that a century before, Charles Elliott had purchased all this land along the river that had since been encroached on by businesses and people and residential homes. And he started to envision creating green paths, like bike paths, along the Charles and native plantings, so he would re-green the banks. And the amazing thing, as I say at the beginning of the book, is he did it. This is not a depressing environmental story. This is an exciting one. He actually, through energy, charisma, and sheer oomph, managed to get this land back, have people agree to putting the pass through and the native plantings, and things that were like the parking lot of a super Stop and Shop suddenly were a green and marshy forest. So he spent 20 years doing that and did it in his own unique style, and I really admired it.
And what was it about his style that makes him the kind of environmentalist that you think we need more of?
Well, he's kind of a, you know, towny guy from Newton and outside of Boston. He says early on, I don't know how much swearing I'm allowed to do on the writer's voice, but he says early on that he, as a kid, had his ass dragged out to Lincoln to learn about nature. And what he wants to show is that nature can be closer to home. And he says, I think in the second page of the book, he says, maybe if people in Boston, kids in Boston, get out to the water, they can be inspired and they can be the next John Muir. And then he kind of corrects himself and says, or at least maybe they can be less of a dick. So he's kind of saying that, you know, that contact with the natural world is something essential. And the thing I like about it is, at this time I was writing the book, everything was green this, green that, green underarm deodorant, you know, green toothpaste. But everybody talked about that stuff, but they didn't seem to talk about where it starts, which is getting out in the world and going for walks and being in the world. And at the end of the book, I do bullet points, and the first two are fall in love with the place and start a fight about that place. And to me, that's the piece that's missing when everybody gets green. They forget about the actual green.
I take your point.
I didn't mean to make it so adamantly.
No, and I think it's an important one. I do take it. But I have to say, you know, I probably am in that camp that you criticize so roundly in the book, you know, the people who are in the equivalent of a panic attack, because we probably have run out of time. So have you been able to kind of integrate these two things?
Yeah, yeah. Up to this point, I've given you the standard Green Manifesto spiel. But this is really good. I mean, this is exactly, to me, this is one of the central parts of the book. I do criticize roundly, you know, quite a few people, but I don't think I criticize the doom and gloom thing because I believe it. I'm with you. And when I really think about it a lot, and I know species are dying every day and population booming, I, like you, have that equivalent of a intellectual kind of panic attack about it. And I don't think that's wrong. I think that's a legitimate response to very dark times environmentally. And I'm not criticizing that response. I'm saying, okay, there's that response. And then just like in our lives when we have panic attacks, how do we get out of them? And my experience has been, we usually get out of them through small actions and momentum and movement. Just like with writing, if you're overwhelmed by the book, the big book idea, well, you start and work on a chapter and you get momentum building. So all I'm saying is, even if doom is a fact of the future, we still have to wake up the next day. We still have our coffee. We still go to work. So I take Dan as an example of somebody who's done small things that can actually lead to fairly large things. It's not like I'm being head in the sand hopeful and saying this is going to save the world, but it's got to start with something, you know. And so to me, as the book started to evolve, at one point I got where I said, this is a young adult book in a lot of ways. I'm writing this for my 16-year-old self because I didn't know what to do. And one of the things to do is, just as a writer follows, you know, wants to do what they love, so people fighting for the green world do. And so the end of that chapter, the last phrase is, go get them. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's kind of, it doesn't solve that problem. I'm totally with you on the big problem, but I still come around to the practical element of what is to be done, you know, what is to be done today.
You also have come to this whole, in your own environmentalism through an evolution. You were very influenced by, I guess he was kind of a mentor to you, John Hay, the naturalist.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about him and your relationship to him and how that kind of set you on this path?
Well, it's actually, you know, I read Thoreau a lot as a young person. My wife and I took my daughter to Walden a couple of years ago, and my wife pointed to the Carnus stones and said, you know, this is where the cabin was of the man who ruined Daddy's life. Because when I was 16, you know, I started reading Walden, and I've gone this route ever since. I didn't get to know John until a little later, until I was in my later 30s. So my writing was kind of already established. So it was less turning me in a new direction than confirming a lot of things I believed. He'd spent 50 years in the same place, kind of married to the place, and on Cape Cod and Brewster. And he really kind of put his money where his mouth was in terms of living a life in nature. And that was exciting to me. But just as much as I defined myself by him and was inspired by him, I realized we had differences. I'm 50 now, which means I grew up with Saturday Night Live and Mad Magazine, so there was always a layer of irony and humor in my work that was different than John's. So it was really great to have this guy who both affirmed and made me kind of question my own work. And he was just a great man, too. He just passed away at 95 this spring.
So, David Gessner, in my Green Manifesto, in your new book, you also talk, I think, very tellingly, very movingly about how we are not separate from nature. We are animals. I loved this part of your book because I've been doing a lot of thinking about it. How does this fit into the new environmentalism?
Well, I guess I was talking about limited environmentalism, and I brought up the hypocrite example and the urban nature example. But another way is to just accept that it's not great, pure nature over there and human beings over here in another box. And it just seems so obvious to me. I mean, we all kind of know we're animals, but we get reminders of it in deep ways every now and then. And the two examples I use is before my daughter was born, everybody warned me my life was about to change. And the implication was that it would become tamer. And then I described the scene during the C-section when she came bloody out of my wife's middle and merged with her arms over her head victorious. And the sheer tingling animal wild sensation I had then and how it reminded me of nothing more than my dad's death when I'd been holding his hand 6 years before. And to me, those are wild moments, too. They're not separate than seeing gannets dive or whales breach. And so I think it's important to remember that not only are we animals, but for eons, we grew up in close proximity to the natural world. And this has always been our life. So suddenly yanking us out of there and saying, that's some separate thing like scrimshaw or yoga or this is something over there, is not a healthy thing. I mean, I'm happiest and my writing goes best when I'm out in the tramping around or kayaking around or out in the world. And I think that I'm not unique in that.
And then you have a kind of a running argument with two of my favorite punching bags as well. Those are two guys named Nordhaus and Schellenberger of the Breakthrough Institute. They've actually come in for an awful lot of criticism from many environmentalists who feel that they're really kind of a wolf in sheep's clothing. You know, talk a little bit about them. And
well, you know, they the death of environmentalism was a paper that got a lot of attention. Their book a little less so. But they were basically saying that the old environmental ways, the groovy ways, were, you know, needed to be flushed down the toilet and we needed to start fresh. But what they put in its stead seems very dry and policy-driven and wonkish. And I at one point compared them to Kirk and Spock looking down at the world from above, having never really set foot on Earth. Actually, I changed it to Spock and Spock because it felt more like that. So I just thought they missed the whole, they're big proponents of anti-NIMBYism, not in my backyard. They don't like people who fight for their backyard. And I said, I understand that argument, but it usually starts in your backyard. When I was paddling through the Charles, you'd see these great backyards with tire swings and forts and docks, and you know that the kids who grew up there had a good sense of that place, or most of them. And that's where it starts, in your backyard. So that bothered me about their argument. And here's a, you know, you mentioned Return of the Osprey at the beginning. I talked about how, for me, a large reason I write about this is getting so excited about ospreys and following them down to Cuba and Venezuela. And to them, that might seem old-school environmentalism, like waxing rhapsodic about an animal. But I use the example from Return of the Osprey of Art Cooley and Dennis Pulliston, who loved and fell in love with ospreys on Long Island in the late 50s, then start to fight for them in the 60s, and they read Silent Spring, and they get DDT outlawed on Long Island. They form a group that then becomes the Environmental Defense Fund. They start outlawing it around the country until it's outlawed everywhere in the U.S., and their motto is Sue the Bastards. So it went from this very poetic, you know, beautiful, love the bird, to this fighting energy. And that, to me, you know, they don't like the old school Rachel Carson way. That's the old school Rachel Carson way that still excites me and a lot of other people.
And that's so interesting that you mentioned that, because, you know, I'm spending most of my time these days right out in Long Island, very, very near where there are a number of osprey nests. And my almost daily activity is to walk out there in the Merrill Sanctuary, you know, with my binoculars and see those osprey that give me so much pleasure.
Yeah.
And just to think that it started out there.
Yeah, and you know, Long Island's a little underrated in terms of, I said in the osprey book, ospreys made me do something I never thought I would, which is like Long Island, you know, and I really have come to really appreciate the fights that started there and spread around the country. And that's another example of a limited wild. Who thinks, you know, who listening to this in other parts of the country is going to think, oh, Long Island? But Cape Cod's a little like that, too, especially this time of year. But there are these glimpses of really amazing wild things. I mentioned in the book that I saw gannets diving down into Cape Cod Bay right as humpback whales came up. So it was, you know, you can, if you get outside and look around, you can still catch these things. It doesn't mean that bad times aren't ahead. They are. But I still think, you know, we go back to Thoreau as the model. To paraphrase him, he said, I wouldn't walk around the corner to see the world blow up. It's funny that so much of his quest was a personal one and a spiritual one, and yet when you play Trivial Pursuit, if you look at the card that says, who was Martin Luther King and Gandhi's main influence, and flip it over, it's Thoreau. Wow. So by tunneling inward so much and by trying to live a good life, he actually does have a social, you know, political impact. And I love that about, you know, I use that in the book to describe Dan Driscoll, saying he retreated and got really into nature, and that's what led to him bringing the gift of greening the Charles back to the people of Boston.
Yeah, I want to get back to how he did that, but first, just make the observation that Thoreau also kind of began his career as a nature writer by taking a river trip. I believe it was down the Merrimack with his brother?
Yeah, Concord and Merrimack, right, yeah.
So here we are back on the river. First, kind of describe the Charles to us, and then tell us about some of the some of the important fights that and ways that your friend Dan Driscoll was able to transform it.
Well, first, it was for me, it was a 3-day trip. Really, it's not that far. It's Hopkinton to Boston, which is the marathon, basically the Boston Marathon, though it meanders. In fact, that was the Native American name, meant meander, originally for the Charles. But the first day, I was going to go with Dan, and he got called into a meeting, a political meeting. So fighting for the river took precedence over paddling the river. So I was on my own. And he gave me a loaner kayak, very fancy, couple thousand dollar, and he cringed as he watched me slam into rocks heading out from, you know, from near the source. So I paddled from pretty much dawn till dusk and didn't see another human being all day. And if I'd closed my eyes and opened them again, I could have imagined myself in Belize or, different species. But, it was just amazing. It was a wild day, and saw deer, sharp-shinned hawk. So that was day one. And then day two with Dan was we started in this kind of wildness. And then when we went under Route 128, kind of the St. Louis Arch of Boston, and suddenly we were in a more urban wild, and we'd see openings in chain-link fences where people came down to have their beers on a homemade dock on Friday afternoons, and we'd see a lot more industrial development. And we camped that night in Long Ditch in Dedham, and it was this high field of grasses, pretty close to the city, but a little island so nobody could get there. And Dan macheted down the grasses and set up our tent there. And then from the tent, we paddled across Cow Island Pond into Roxbury to the Old Irish Ale House. And we came up behind, and people were looking down from the balcony, and we tied it to the back of the Old Irish Ale House and climbed up a muddy bank and had steaks and vodka gimlets there. And then we got back in the canoe and paddled home, and we saw Dan's first osprey ever on the Charles as we were paddling home. It was pretty intense. And so it became like a very urban wild. And then the next day, as we came into the city, it was July 4th, and Dan yelled to somebody, you know, how did the Red Sox do last night? And it became much more of a social river, which is also, it has a history as being a social river because people focused on the Charles in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and then they kind of turned their back on it after World War II. The city turned its back on it. It became very industrial and crappy and dirty water. And so what Dan did was not only go door to door and talk people into the idea of these bike paths, which were first, of course, people thought bitterly. It was like the Willie Horton thing. Oh, people are going to come from downtown and, you know, rape everybody and kill everybody. And he had to convince them in town meetings, he had to convince politicians that this would, in fact, unify neighborhoods and would increase the property value of the houses because suddenly you'd have this contact with the river. And he could have used legal means. He could have, Boston did own people's backyards, talk about not in my backyards, but he managed to put a vision forth that people eventually, after years, bought into. And that included things like the corporate guys weren't really bad guys here. They, once they bought into the vision, became stewards of places like the Stop and Shop and other businesses, and they really take pride in having that out behind their buildings.
Well, it's more than a lovely book. I mean, after all you say in this book, you didn't want to write another Pretty Little Nature book about Pretty Little Nature.
Yeah.
It is really more than that. It's a great read. It's a lot of fun to read. It's very thought-provoking. But it's also a lovely book to read because I think it does kind of bring back the sense that we can do something, that fighting for the world and for our future and our children's future is something that starts right here at home. Thanks so much for talking with us about it. My Green Manifesto is the name of the book. It's just been great to talk with you here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much, Francesca.
David Gessner is the author of, among other books, Return of the Osprey and Soaring with Fidel. You can hear my 2007 interview with Gessner about Soaring with Fidel by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.